Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recent or forthcoming publications by faculty at Vanderbilt University. I'm Chris Benda, librarian for religious studies and theology at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Jürg Grieger, distinguished professor of theology, Cal Turner Chancellor's Chair of Wesleyan Studies, and the founding director of the Wendland Cook Program in Religion and Justice, about his recent book, Jesus Versus Caesar, for people tired of serving the wrong God. Jürg, thanks for being willing to do this interview.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. I'm looking forward to it.
Great. You claim in this recent book that the fundamental tension at the heart of Christianity is the tension between Jesus and Caesar, which you characterize as, quote, the tension between faith that is life-giving for all, not just a few, and faith that is not. The tension is between one kind of sacred and another kind of sacred, between one set of religious traditions and another set. And since faith and religion are always embodied, we are also talking about the tension between some ways of life and others, unquote. So if this has been a central tension for Christianity since its beginnings, what brings you to write about it now, at this particular time?
I think especially right now, that's one of the problems we have with religion, namely that the United States is still a fairly religious place, even though people say, you know, we're losing our religion. I mean, compared to Europe, where I come from, many other places, religion plays a strong role, and the role it's playing is actually ambiguous, I would say, at the least, because a lot of what religion does is not necessarily life-giving to a lot of people. It seems to be setting limits, it seems to be controlling people, it seems to be having negative effects on the environment. And so what I'm worried about is that there's a lot of religion today that is not life-giving, that's perhaps more harmful, if anything. And so for those of us who are, you know, not only studying religion, but embodying it, this is an important question to raise.
When you, just to sort of set this aside at the beginning, when you talk about Caesar and Jesus, to what extent are you referring to these as historical figures or as sort of metaphors for
It sort of starts with the historical figures,
yeah.
You know. That's what a lot of people perhaps forget, that Jesus was born already under the conditions of an empire. So there was, already a power struggle going on. There was religion, there was empire religion on the one hand, and there was this life-giving religion, as I will call it, which is sort of anti-empire religion on the other hand. And, you know, you could say, historically speaking, there is, of course, Jesus within Judaism, who is embodying a very different tradition than what you find with Caesar in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Romans were, in fact, you know, broad-minded, open-minded. They were religiously tolerant people. They could imagine, you know, believing in all kinds of gods, not just their own. But the Romans had this issue with the Christian God because that God didn't look like a god to them.
Mm.
You know, if a god is something, you know, that's dominant, sitting on a throne up in heaven, you know, ruling from the top down. The Christian God, especially via Jesus, didn't look like that. You know, was somebody who was crucified on the cross, who was a troublemaker, a rabble-rouser. And so in that sense, I think there is a historical conflict between, you know, what this religion of Jesus embodies, I mean, what the tradition of Judaism that Jesus embodies stands for, and what the dominant religion stands for. So if you look at the historical situation, you'd have to say there is already something going on in the beginning of Christianity that could be very instructive for us. But at the same time, it's also metaphorical, because I think this is a challenge that we're facing again today in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll be talking about in more detail.
And that's the exciting thing. You know, so in a way, for me to go back to the history, the beginnings of Christianity, I think, is necessary, because we just don't want to talk about our own ideas and feelings, but we want to talk about something that's at the heart of what I think is Christianity. Yet at the same time, this becomes only relevant when we talk about what's happening today. And so I do this as a theologian rather than as a historian. Maybe put it this way, I do it as a historically informed theologian.
Right. And I actually, I'll have a further... I may just go ahead and ask you that now. You're a historically informed theologian. Yet in this book, and not only in this book, you focus quite a bit on the Gospels and on Jesus. And that isn't necessarily the case. This may come as a surprise to some listeners, but that isn't necessarily the case for all theologians. There are a lot of theologians that don't necessarily spend a lot of time looking at the biblical text to the degree that you do. What are some of the reasons why biblical interpretation, why even the historical Jesus are important? Is it just sort of grounding things? Is that kind of the central reason?
I think that's part of it, but maybe I need to go back to the beginning of your questions. You know, why engage that now? I mean, let me put it this way. I'm really worried that Christianity as a religion has gone off track in the United States because it's so oftentimes, not only is it destructive, but it stands with the interests of the powerful. You know, it has a certain flavor. You know, when people hear Christianity, you know, around the world, when they think about American Christianity, they think of the Christian right. They think of sort of a dominant, maybe civil religion that you find in the United States, which is usually very American. You know, it's sort of the American way of life. And so in order to address that, you know, how do you counter that? How do you even find anything sort of to say to that? And so I think it's for that reason that, that I feel, you know, we need to have some resources. We cannot simply talk about how I feel about this or how you feel about this or if we like what's going on or what's not going on. We really have to go, well, in this case, back, you know, to some of the founding documents on the one hand, you know, to some of the ancient traditions. And I believe by doing that, we can actually find some alternatives that you would not be able to see otherwise. So in this sense, you know, going back to some of the scriptural resources, and that includes not only the New Testament, I think it also includes the traditions of the Hebrew Bible on which Jesus drew, that sort of helps you build a case in a situation where Christianity in so many ways has sold out to the dominant powers. So in a way, I don't think we even have much of a choice here. It's not just a personal preference, but I think we just need to use all that we have, and this is certainly crucial tools. Of course, you could also argue theologically, right? You could say that for Protestant Christians, generally, the Bible is an important resource. I happen to be a Methodist, so in Methodism, we believe in the primacy of Scripture. So that's another reason. But I think this reason goes so much deeper because we cannot do this work without sort of our ancestry, our traditions, our heritage.
Is some of it also possibly the people that you're speaking to who might be expecting or they've gotten their own formulations of how to interpret Scripture, and you want to kind of give them, you want to show them, hey, Scripture isn't necessarily saying what you think it's, what you've been taught that it's
Yes,
saying.
That's a really good question, because ultimately, you know, who do you do theology for? I mean, at one level, you really do it for people of faith, you know, people who want to take the Scripture seriously. And so what I oftentimes find when you argue via the Scriptures that people want to take seriously, you really can build a case that you could not build any other ways. I find this especially, I do a lot of global traveling and lecturing. So last week I was in Kenya at a World Council of Churches meeting on interreligious dialogue and liberation. And then I gave a little presentation at a local university where, you know, most people probably, you know, from the U.S. perspective, you would say they're evangelicals, you know, with a Pentecostal touch. And there, you argue with the Bible, people really pay attention. So I'm saying a few radical things in this book, you know, and elsewhere. And if I can back it up with the Bible, I find people are really paying attention. But, of course, it's the kind of people that would already have a feeling that the Bible is important to them.
Right. Sticking with the question about audience, the subtitle of your book is For People Tired of Serving the Wrong God. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you imagine who these people are and why they feel the way that they do. But I also wanted to ask, so does your subtitle assume that charitably most people are tired of serving the wrong God? Or are you anticipating that there's a group of people who probably aren't in your audience?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'm certainly part of that audience myself. You know, I was raised in the church, you know, a fifth generation German Methodist, spent all my life in the church, basically. The problems I have with the church, the church is a human institution, it's fallible and all of that. At least we Protestants believe that. But the problem I have is that it oftentimes not only has some mistakes, but it tends to serve idols, you know, without knowing it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I got tired of myself. And then I looked around me and I found a lot of people, even in the churches, you know, who sort of are not with it anymore because they feel like the church either is playing sandbox games, you know, doing stuff that doesn't really matter, or, you know, the church is just celebrating itself, has become narcissistic. That's another false god, you know, you don't even care about, ask the question of God anymore. But then, you know, even more so, there was a recent study that came out I can't remember the exact numbers, but the result of the study was from 2009 to 2019, so many people have left the church. So church attendance and church membership is really shrinking fast in the United States. By the way, as a footnote, this reminds me of growing up in Germany, you know, a few decades ago, where we saw the same thing, you know, and people back then thought, well, the church is the church, you know, it will be fine. But more and more people were leaving the church. My generation in Germany, when we were young, sort of, you know, teenagers, college age, we were leaving the church. And here's the striking thing. I find that a lot of people these days, young people, are leaving the church not because they have lost faith in God, but they have lost faith in the God that's worshiping the churches. So that's an interesting situation. You think people leaving the church, they're done with religion and faith in God. But that's not maybe the reason they're leaving. They're leaving because the church seems to be worshiping something that they don't recognize as God. So that's sort of, in some ways you could say it's young people leaving the church, but it's also aging people, you know, who are wondering what have we invested our lives in all these years. So it's, I think it's a growing group in the United States. And there's even churches, even people in the churches who haven't quite recognized yet that they're probably also among that group. And so as people are waking up, of course, the call of the book then is not to say, let's stop serving God, but instead of serving the wrong God, let's find the right God and see if we can serve that God, what that would look like.
Right. So what you were saying about people, particularly young people, leaving the church, not necessarily because they don't believe in God anymore, but because of problems that they have with the God that's being presented to them, is a great segue into talking about the five challenges or consequences that occupy the main part of your book. These are challenges or consequences that result from this tension between Jesus and Caesar, this conflict between Jesus and Caesar. And so we're going to look at each of these challenges briefly. And this first one is what you've just described, the increasing alienation that many people feel towards Christianity, or even just religion, not just Christianity. And they become, you know, some folks become spiritual but not religious, whatever that means, and some become agnostic and some become atheist. But you don't necessarily see that as a problem. The notion that somebody is adopting atheism, and I have scare quotes here.
Yes, right.
You actually see this as sort of a building block. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you mean when you're sort of embracing this move that particularly young people, but others have away from Christianity towards not God.
Yeah, right. So, well, let me start. This is sort of the beginning. This is the first chapter of the mm-hmm. book where it's maybe an outrageous claim, but I'll put it out there in the hope that people will keep listening, so don't turn off quite yet. But this notion that maybe at the heart of Christianity is something like atheism.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds preposterous, right? Isn't Christianity believe in God? But what I mean by that goes back to the history. You know, the early Christians in the Roman Empire were accused of being atheists.
Mm-hmm.
So there were some Roman philosophers that basically said, you know, these Christians, they're not worshiping God. Now, atheism, keep in mind here, does not mean the rejection of any and all gods, but it means the rejection of the gods who are recognized as gods by theism. And so there are certain rules and principles, right? So a god has to be omnipotent, you know, impassible, immutable, at the top of the universe, you know, wielding power in a certain way. And for these Romans, that sort of god would have looked pretty much like the Roman emperor, somebody with tremendous amounts of power, which is the reason why certain emperors were also declared divine. That was for the Romans, sort of, that made a lot of sense to think that way. And so for Christians to be called atheists, I mean, the Romans were not stupid. They knew they believed in a god. They just did not recognize the Christian God as God.
Mm.
So atheism here was a way of saying you do not believe in the gods of the empire. And I'm envisioning that the early Christians, some of them might have used this as a badge of honor to say, you know, we're not worshiping these gods. We're worshiping a God who is the God of Jesus Christ, who wields power in a very different way, you know, who is in solidarity with the common people, who sort of all the way back to the Exodus, you know, is the one who liberates the slaves, who supports those, you know, who suffer. That's the ministry of Jesus, right? Proclaim good news to the poor, liberation to the oppressed, and so on. So then adopting this accusation of atheism is a way of saying we reject the gods of empire in order to reclaim a different god. And that god is precisely not the god of theism. And I think this is maybe the biggest confusion in the church today, because people assume when they say God, they know what God is. And this is, of course, what then gets misused by the powers that be, say, in elections. You know, when whoever wants to be elected now references God, Christians think, oh, this is my God. Instead of asking the question, is this the God of empire or is this the God of Jesus Christ? So in this sense, you know, having some critical questions about God is not necessarily a bad thing. I would actually say it's required. If you want to find the true God, you have to ask a few questions first. And then really you can make some decisions, rather than assuming that God is whatever's at the top, you know, or God is whatever's in power right now. That's sort of the default position. So then again, saying that at the heart of Christianity is atheism is a way of saying we Christians do not accept all God claims. And the big question here is not in religious dialogue. The question is, what claims of God are made in our own culture? Which claims of God are made within Christianity? And then you sort out who is God and who isn't. I'll give you the most blatant example.
Sure.
Every listener today will probably, well, not every, but most probably would understand what I'm talking about. If you think about my own history, the history of the German people, where you have, you know, fascism, where you have the Third Reich, Nazi Germany, there were a lot of Christians that equated God and Hitler, that saw Hitler as taking not only the place of God, but acting in the place of God. And in those days, you know, if you were falling for that, of course, you know, you had to become a Nazi. And so I think this is the crucial question, you know, who do we think embodies God? What is sort of in the place of God? And then to be very clear, not anything goes. Mm-hmm. Of course, the difficult theological question for us today is who is falsely claiming to be God today? And that's why I'm doing theology, because I think that's the crucial question.
Hmm. What you've been saying is related in a lot of ways to the second challenge that you talk about, which is the ways that some folks think that their Christian faith is somehow beholden to a particular political program. And it doesn't matter that program might be harmful in various ways. There's a linkage between their Christian faith and a political platform or a political person, a candidate, or a a politician of some kind or another.
Yes.
And you invoke Jesus's famous and perhaps often misunderstood statement, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. How do you interpret that statement? What is Jesus saying, and how does that address this challenge that you've identified?
So one way of reading this, and I think this is sort of a modern way of reading, is to say there's a separation, there's politics on the one hand, there's religion on the other hand. And so a lot of people think when you say, or when Jesus all the way mm-hmm. back said, you know, give to God what's God and what Caesar what is Caesar's, politics belongs to Caesar, religion belongs to God.
Mm.
Now, for a Jew at the time of Jesus, you know, people sort of who were trained in the Jewish Hebrew traditions, they would remember the beginning of the book of Genesis, which is also part of our Bible now, where in the beginning it says God created heaven and earth. And so if that's the way you were raised, and somebody would ask you what belongs to God,
mm-hmm.
What would be your answer, right? I mean,
heaven and earth.
Everything imaginable, right?
Yeah.
Heaven and earth, visible and invisible, everything belongs to God. And so you can't really split reality up that way. You can't really say, you know, oh, God's only for religion, and then everything else gets ruled by Caesar. And so when Jesus puts this before, you know, or this is his response to people, basically, that ask him, you know, should we pay taxes? And he's basically saying, you know, give God what is God's, everything. And then, you know, that is why the response, you know, in this passage, if you go back to the Gospels, the response is, you know, people are sort of, you know, realizing that this guy is a lot smarter, is a lot better theologian than they thought he was, you know, so he cannot easily be trapped, because it might be an ambiguous answer. But at the same time, for somebody steeped in this Jewish religion, he or she or they would understand this is really talking about something much bigger than what we thought it would be. And so ultimately it amounts to a critique of Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically saying, you know, if Caesar is even part of this game, you know, we might have to think about God first and then ask, how does Caesar fit in with this? Whereas today I think it goes the other way around. Even those people who want to separate religion and politics, they somehow assume that Caesar is there because God put him there, you know, or
mm-hmm.
because sort of there is some sort of a match made where you can serve both. But for Jesus, I don't think you can.
Mm.
And so that's the beauty. And by the way, this is not just my own reading of it. I think there is some agreement among New Testament scholars now also
mm-hmm.
that you can read this passage in that way,
mm-hmm.
that you really have to read it as a paradoxical challenge of the power of Caesar. And of course, translate that into the situation of the United States today. That would apply to anybody in power.
Mm.
Now, we usually think of presidents,
because
that's sort of what comes to mind at first. but some of the most powerful people in this country are, of course, people of great fortune and wealth. Now we do happen to have a president who is both, so so that maybe compounds the situation. But that's the question here. You know, is what belongs to God, and ultimately what Jesus is saying. You know, all power, all wealth, heaven and earth, visible and invisible, all of that belongs to God, and God can challenge this. So don't assume that's what's out there is automatically God given, but ask. You know, Abraham Lincoln, I think, put it this way. The question is not necessarily, I mean, in sort of paraphrasing that, but the question is not necessarily if God is on your side, but if you're on God's side. So Caesar would have to be double checked. You know, is this person in power, this group in power, CEO, president, you name it, university professor, pastor, you know, anybody, are they in sync with God rather than the other way around?
The third challenge you talk about is perhaps the most paradoxical in terms of how you discuss it. And that has to do with the whole issue of materialism. I know in religious contexts, and maybe not just in religious contexts, but it seems to be most in religious contexts, we hear that we live in a materialistic culture, that we're too materialistic. And as you've done with in the previous chapters, you sort of kind of adopt a slightly different view on this whole question. So what do you do with materialism? What does the material, what place does it have in Christianity or in religion more generally?
I mean, one thing I'm doing in this chapter is sort of really reclaiming the value of the material, because I'm afraid this has oftentimes gotten lost in Christianity, that has become too spiritualized. And spiritualized here means otherworldly. I'm actually saying that Christian spirituality does not have to be otherworldly, because I mean, think about Jesus' spirituality. You know, it's not so much sending people to heaven, but it's healing people, it's preaching good news to the poor. And what's good news to the poor? Well, you will no longer be poor, right? That's sort of good news to the poor. It's sort of bringing communities back together again. So Jesus' ministry is actually pretty materially oriented, you know, and then sort of if you think about life after death, that sort of follows from that, but it's not the primary or the ultimate goal necessarily. I mean, it's just something that happens because, you know, Jesus then gets resurrected. It's not even the immortality of Jesus that's at stake, but it's this way of life that's at stake and that gets resurrected. So there's already a fairly material tone in the New Testament, but if you take this back sort of to the Hebrew Bible, there it's, I think it's even clearer. You know, a lot of people don't realize that this whole sort of idea of going to heaven after you die is really a fairly modern idea, and in the Hebrew Bible, in most of the writings, you don't even find it. So what is salvation for Abraham? Or what is salvation for Moses? It's not, oh, you will go to heaven when you die, but I will bless you, I will make you
a great nation.
Yeah, exactly, yes, that's right. I will lead you out of Egypt into a land flowing with milk and honey. I mean, those are material, very material things. And if you look at the prophets, you know, what are they complaining about? I mean, they're saying, you know, you're not treating people well, you know, you're exploiting people. You should live a different life. And then you can come back and worship. You know, we're just going through Amos in the class this morning, where Amos basically says, you know, where you know, God through the prophet Amos says, seek me and live. Don't go to the religious places, but seek me and live. And so in this case, the way I read this is sort of all very material promises. Now, here's the challenge, because we now also have the so-called gospel of prosperity, which is promising material wealth and great wealth in many cases, right? So for Christians who hear me talk about this material concern of these Jewish and Christian traditions, By the way, you have these material concerns, I would say, also in the other Abrahamic religion, Islam, where, I mean, not that heaven is unimportant, but it's really about living your life on this earth with God. That's sort of the focus of it. And then if you do that, you know, your life continues with God after you die. That's not a big issue. That's just the way it happens. But if you compare that sort of with the gospel of prosperity, there the idea is not material as such, but it's a specific kind of materialism. You know, that's more like what you get in capitalism, the idea of winner take all. You know, the person at the top gets everything. I was when I was in Kenya in Nairobi last week, there was a young pastor who was driving me around, and we were talking about his ministry, and he said, in my church, most people are casual laborers. And I really care about their well-being. They're having trouble making ends meet, and so in our church, we're helping them with that. We're sort of helping them, you know, to find better employment, you know, to do all these kinds of things that would make them and their families, you know, happier and you know, safer and live a decent life that way. So I sort of facetiously asked him, so isn't that the gospel of prosperity? And he laughed and he said, no, the gospel of prosperity is this preacher, also in Nairobi, who has two private airplanes. So it's not us, it's them. And so what I'm saying in this chapter is, you know, this whole focus on the material, you can have very different ways of, there are very different ways of focusing on the material. One is sort of winner take all, get rich quick, you know, get as much as possible. And the other focus is, you know, let's make sure everybody has enough to live. Everybody can live a decent life. Everybody has, you know, work that sustains them, you know, that nourishes them, that helps their communities flourish, those kinds of things. So in this sense, I think Christianity, rather than having a knee-jerk reaction against the gospel of prosperity, needs to reclaim a different way of, you know, valuing material life. And that leads to valuing creation, valuing the environment, you know, valuing people around you, all of that.
The material isn't just the economic, the financial, but it's the world. I mean, everything.
That's right. So yeah. A minute ago we were saying God created heaven and earth.
Right.
Well, if that's what it is, that's what we're called to be working with. You know, this is sort of the concern, I think, for people who are following Jesus to live a life in this world in such a way, you know, that people can flourish, that life can actually be a good life. And then spirituality in this context doesn't mean get away from life as fast as possible, but it's a new way of life that appreciates material well-being for all. The focus here is, I think, the difference between the gospel of prosperity and the material prosperity that I'm talking about is gospel of prosperity is talking about material wealth for a few. It never will raise a whole community out of poverty. That's not possible. There's always only a few that get wealthy through the gospel of prosperity, and usually it's the pastors and a few others. Whereas we're talking about wealth for all. So the for all is really what changes the game. Because now we're saying it's not just if I'm doing well, but if everybody else can live a decent life.
Right.
And once you go there, I think spirituality means the well-being of all, a way of life that enables that, that is in touch with your neighbors, that is in touch with God, that is in touch, you know, with heaven and earth in a whole new way.
The fourth challenge is related in some ways with what we've been talking about, the economic side of things, and that is the ways in which religion and economics, God and mammon, tend to become intertwined. And you've kind of gestured towards that in what you've said already. But I wonder if you could go in a little bit more detail about some of the consequences of the dominant world economic system, which you identify as capitalism, and you're not the only one. And what do the Gospels say about the the consequences of this system and how we should be living to sort of ameliorate them or address them in some other way.
You know, I think this is one of the big challenges for our day, for various reasons. If you go through the book, you know, we already talked about Jesus and politics.
Right.
And when it comes to politics, you know, if you look at the American Constitution, for instance, there's a lot of wisdom when it talks about the separation of church and state. It doesn't mean that these things are completely unrelated, but that it might be worthwhile to think about the limits of how much one is affecting the other. And when you talk about economics, money, and wealth, we don't have that at all. Mm-hmm. So there's no separation of church and big money, which is, I think, start right there. This is one of the big problems in the church today. Mm. Just let's be honest about this, and this is not anybody's evil intention. It's just the way the system functions, you know. That pastors, churches who are dependent on donations, oftentimes big donors, need to make sure they're not offending anybody, mm. That their interests, that come with money, that nobody feels like they can speak up against. Even in theological education these days, we've learned a lot about, the problems of sexism, racism, ethnocentrism, heterosexism, you name it. But we're still pretty hesitant to talk about money because we know there's somebody who pays our bills.
Right.
And so even if you look in sort of the theological literature, there's something missing here. Now, that has been part of my work in other books, but here I'm bringing it back in order to say, there's nothing wrong with thinking about economics, but we have to think about how economics shapes up today in such a way that it shapes us all the way to the core. Mm. And so, in an economic system, I said a minute ago, one of the problems of the gospel of prosperity is winner takes all. Mm-hmm. This is the problem of capitalism, winner takes all. Now, that sounds a little simplistic, I know, but what I mean by that is if you think about a corporation, the way the current law in the U.S. is structured, corporations, their mission is to build the wealth of the corporation, which ultimately is the wealth of the shareholders. Mm. So it's not even the wealth of the CEOs. People usually think money goes to the CEO. I mean, CEOs are well compensated, but the bigger issue is wealth is built for the shareholders and explicitly not for the workers, mm-hmm. And explicitly not for the community, and explicitly not for the environment. I mean, I'm sorry, that's just the way it is right now. In the common situation of how businesses are run. And so that's what I mean by winner mm-hmm. take all, that wealth is funneled in a certain direction, and it doesn't necessarily either trickle down or spread out into the communities. And so in a situation like that, you can imagine it's not just about money. Politics functions like that, oftentimes money or politics follows money. Now, I'm a theologian. I'm worried about religion and theology, and what I'm worried about is that theology and religion follow money too often. And so what do we do about that,
yeah.
right? Of course, we can criticize it. We can speak out against it. But we could also engage in different economic practices. Mm. And that's part of what we're doing, actually. We have this new program at Vanderbilt Divinity School called the Wendland Cook Program mm-hmm. in Religion and Justice. So here we're talking about these things, economics, ecology as well, but we're not just discussing it, we're also sort of embracing different ways of being a worker, being mm-hmm. in business. So we're working closely with the Southeast Center of Cooperative Development, building co-ops mm-hmm. is a way mm-hmm. of actually cooperative businesses is a way of making sure that profit is not a dirty word. Profits actually get spread around into the community mm. and to the people who work rather than just a small group of shareholders or people who control the wealth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's a big yeah. issue, but yeah. I think this is why theologians have to think about it, because ultimately it comes back and bites us if we don't pay attention.
Yes, it's kind of a blind spot, I guess, for or as you've been suggesting, it's been something of a blind spot.
And so the beauty here is, you know, when all one needs to do is sort of start working on it, engaging it, and that's sort of my invitation here,
right.
To say, you know, what happens when you pay attention to these blind spots, and
right.
new things will come.
The fifth challenge, in some ways, comes out of Jesus's statement, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." And that is the relationship of one religion, and this book is focused on Christianity, so that's your focus, to other religions. That seems like Jesus' comment seems like a little bit of a complication for
right?
how Christianity relates to other religions. So how do you deal with that particular complication? What kind of resources exist for Christians who don't want to have the sense that, you know, Christianity is necessarily it, and let's forget about everybody else.
So this is the famous passage, right? It's John 14, verse 6, in the Johannine Gospel, Jesus says, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life." And here I think it's really important to distinguish between the religion of Caesar and the religion of Jesus, because what I'm saying basically is this notion that truth is unilateral, top-down, easily controlled by someone is an empire notion. This is something that comes, of course, you know, we could look back to the Roman Empire, where Caesar was sort of the one, you have a, you know, monarchy where somebody, one person is at the top who determines this. But I think this is sort of a common way of thinking about truth even today. Truth is determined from the top down by a small committee or a small group of people that have the power, and everybody else has to believe it. What I'm saying in the chapter is I'm not sure that this is how the Jesus movement functioned. So Jesus' claim to be the truth may not have to be the empire's claim to be the one and only truth, and nothing else matters. In Jesus' case, you know, when you talk about the truth in terms of being the way and the life, those things are actually in motion. So Jesus embodies the truth in his ministry. And there's untruth out there. So it's not anything goes, but truth versus untruth, you have to figure it out. You sort of have to figure it out on the way. That's exactly what the disciples did, by the way. You know, they had to figure out, it took them a while, you know, the way the Gospels tell the story, they had 3 years with Jesus, something like that. And they're sort of wavering back and forth, you know, sometimes they get it, then they lose it, and then they get it again. So in a way, you know, it's a truth that gets known, that gets produced perhaps even in walking, in being on the way. And the line that is drawn, so there's a line that's drawn between stuff that's not true, but the line that's drawn is different from what we imagine. So let me give you this example. In the Gospel of John, there's always this notion of the Jews, you know, in scare quotes here, which is not a very helpful notion to begin with. And so a lot of people reading that immediately wonder if John is anti-Semitic, because Jesus in the Gospel of John has some horrible things to say about the Jews, right? But now one could say maybe Jesus is opposed to Judaism in the Gospel of John. That doesn't make any sense, because Jesus is Jewish himself, right? So he's not criticizing the religion of Judaism or the people of Israel. Jesus is actually criticizing a specific expression of the Jewish religion that is on the side of the empire. So it's the religious power brokers, you know, it's the people that ultimately put him on the cross, you know, well, who puts him on the cross? Well, it's the Romans, with somehow the support of some very powerful Jewish religious figures. But it's not the Jews as such, it's not Jewish people, it's not the whole religion. And so what you're getting then with this notion of truth is not one religion against another, but within religions figuring out what is God and what isn't. So for interreligious dialogue, I'll give you that example. I was just at this World Council of Churches meeting. That's why I was in Kenya last week, where we talked about interreligious dialogue. Part of my presentation was to say, The first challenge in interreligious dialogue is not to draw a line between the religions, but to figure out within each religion what is of God and what isn't.
Hmm.
And so, as a Christian, I am a Christian, a committed one at that. My first challenge is to figure out what within Christianity is really of God and what isn't.
Hmm.
And once I figure that out, and once my Buddhist and my Hindu fellow theologians, religious scholars, figure that out, then we can have a conversation.
Mm.
Then we can say maybe there is something that we have in common, you know, where we find this truth that Jesus is talking about. It's no longer the empire truth that's unilateral. It's a truth that becomes open-ended, that allows for other people knowing something that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he draws lines. So the paradox here is, this is why takes me a while to explain this. The paradox here is, in order to really become more inclusive and more open to others, you also have to know what you're up against.
Hmm.
And that starts at home. You know, you have to figure out, is this really God talk that makes sense, or is it not? You know, and so as Christians then refuse to believe certain claims about God, they might find themselves in good company with other people.
Hmm.
So Buddhists, for instance, don't really talk much about God at all, or some Buddhists, you know, are pretty agnostic about notions of God. Well, what they're rejecting is precisely some of these dominant theisms from the top down that Christians are also rejecting.
Hmm.
That doesn't mean we're now alike, therefore, but we have something very interesting to talk about.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, threaded through the chapters is readings of the segments of the Lord's Prayer, which you call a revolutionary manifesto of sorts.
Right.
So what do you mean by that? I mean, why are you bringing the Lord's Prayer into these challenges?
You know, I really think this is a summary of Jesus's theology, and if you read it in this down-to-earth way that I'm suggesting in the book, you know, if you ask about its political consequences, if you ask about its material implications, if you ask about its economic relevance, you're finding that it's actually fairly concise. You know, it's not so much big mysterious language, but it's a manifesto in the sense that Jesus is focusing on those things which could really liberate us and set us free from the false gods. So in this sense, you know, it's not just saying interesting things about God, but it's drawing some distinctions, you know, between the right God and the wrong God. You know, the right God is the one who forgives debt. You know, the wrong God is the one who actually keeps us indebted. You know, the right God is the one, you know, who gives us our daily bread, you know, our daily necessities. The wrong God is the God of scarcity. I mean, you sort of add it up that way, and all of a sudden it becomes very practical. This is something that any person on the street in Jesus' own time could really relate to, because those were the struggles of the people. And even in the beginning, you know, how does it start?
Our Father
in heaven, hallowed be your name.
Yeah.
And that sort of sounds like, well, it goes back to the Ten Commandments, right? You know, hallowing God's name, honoring God's name. What exactly does that mean? Well, do not pray to the wrong gods, you know. Make sure you distinguish between who is God and who isn't. And of course, if you look at the cover of the book, there's an image of Jesus and an image of Caesar. And some people, I mean, I did not do the cover. This was the publisher.
I like the green, yellow, and red.
That's right.
Just noticed that. Guess like who is go and guess who is stop.
Traffic lights, yes. And some people say, you know, Caesar, this is an ancient image, but the smile on his face reminds them of a current president. Sort of, to say, well, who is God and who isn't God? I mean, of course, whoever your president is, you know, no president is ever God.
Right.
But some presidents are further away from God than others. And you know, that's something else that we should talk about. And I would say those of us who would pray the Lord's Prayer every Sunday should make sure we know who is God and who isn't.
Mm.
That sounds like we're not talking politics, but that's part of, I think, what we owe to our faith and what we owe to God.
Mm-hmm. This is... awkward way to point to raise this question, but you raise it yourself. In several places in the book, you, particularly in the beginning and the end, you raise what you call a postmodern argument that would see the dichotomy that you propose as the dichotomy between Jesus and Caesar, which you've articulated actually just in the last response in a variety of different ways. Propose as postmodernist might say, well, what about complexity and ambiguity? You know, don't we all have a little bit of Caesar in us? And this isn't necessarily a postmodern view, but you know, isn't Jesus about love and forgiveness and reconciliation? You know, isn't versus a little bit harsh? So, what, you know, how have you come to take the position? There are things that there are limits. We just can't, you know, accept anything.
I mean, it probably depends on how you were raised and where you're coming from, and I think a lot of us, you know, theologians and people in the church, maybe those of us, myself included, who were raised in more conservative settings, sometimes feel our views were too narrow. You know, they lacked complexity. They had sort of simplistic explanations, and that's an important concern. So so in a way, broadening your horizon, seeing some complexity, is not a bad thing. So I'm not arguing right. against that. But what I'm saying is, you know, once you have gone through this broadening of the horizon, you have to come back and say, you know, what is the real struggle that's going on here? You know, can we simply hang out in the middle, or is there something else going on? There's an old German saying back from the 16th century that in situations of danger and great need, the middle road leads to death. In other words, you have to make a decision. You cannot hang out in the middle. And I think this is what we see today, you know, hanging out in the middle, reaching across the aisle when the world is burning, may not be sufficient. So this is why I think ultimately we have to come back and make some decisions. Now, this is not sort of just some knee-jerk narrowness and narrow-mindedness, but this is now figuring out where is it necessary to take a stand? Where is it not? You know, and maybe your place has changed there. But I think this is following the model of Jesus, too, because for Jesus, it's pretty clear not anything goes. I mean, in that sense, he wasn't a liberal. I mean, people sort of that think about the culture wars, you know, conservatives versus liberal, think, well, Jesus just loved everybody. Well, I mean, if you consider him yelling at certain people in his time as love. That's true.
Tough love.
But that's tough love, yes, exactly. And that means taking aside. You know, I mean, Mary is like that. Read Mary's song of praise in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 1. She says, you know, God lifts up the lowly servant, God fills the hungry with good things, which is all wonderful. And then she says, God pushes the powerful from their thrones. And at the end, she says, the God who fills the hungry with good things sends the rich away empty. Now that's sort of mean, right? That's outright not nice. But maybe this is what it takes to fill the hungry with good things, to lift up the lowly. And I'm really hopeful that this might be, in the end, what will sort of help the rich and the powerful wake up.
Right.
And maybe also embrace a different way. So in that sense, nobody's lost necessarily.
Well, that's why I kind of wondered. I mean, your subtitle says, for people tired of serving the wrong God, which could seem as if you're suggesting there are some people who are perfectly happy. But your your text also talks about the 99%, and even the 1% have a chance.
So, yes, that's right. So that's the good news. But the good news is not, I'm okay, you're okay. But the good news is, you know, there's a way of life, there's a spirituality, there's sort of a way of embracing material reality, the world, politics, and economics. That's life-giving.
Right.
In a situation where a lot of the examples that we see are not life-giving. People get killed every day. People die of starvation, you know. People die behind closed doors for lack of health care. Those kinds of things are pretty serious. So in that world, you know, worshiping a God who is not Caesar, I think, can make a real difference. But in order to do that, you have to make some decisions.
You have to decide who this god is.
You cannot just keep going on with business as usual.
Mm. You mentioned Wendland Cook earlier and some of the things that you're doing. I was wondering if you could talk about some examples of maybe individuals or communities that more closely embody the kinds of perspectives or virtues, I don't know what term to use, that you are advocating in your book.
You know, if you look throughout history, I mean, I think part of the fascinating thing about, I mean, just look at the history of Christianity, the fascinating thing about that history is that throughout its history, there were always communities that have made an effort to live a different life. So all the way back to the book of Acts, you know, in the first couple of chapters, these communities that have everything in common. Now, that doesn't go without struggle. We learned that in the book of Acts. But there's some record of these things, you know, being taken seriously. You know, then you have, say, monastic communities. Then, you know, at the time of the Reformation, you have oftentimes as peasant communities. Initially, Luther was sort of supportive of that. Then he wasn't. Then he turned against the peasants completely. But there were people living not only a different type of communal life, but different type of economic life, different type of politics. And that sort of continued through the ages. So you could find this in all kinds of places. Again, for Methodists, you know, some of these early Methodist developments were also ways of really living a different life rather than just, you know, having a set of beliefs that set you apart. And so, I mean, I guess your question, of course, is how and where is that happening today?
And so
here I would say, to some degree, it's fairly frustrating to see the churches so oftentimes being self-centered, you know. A lot of that these days is not happening in the mainline churches. But again, you know, what I saw in Kenya just now, in this very small, basically a Pentecostal church, it was really about people helping each other. And the pastor sort of being in the midst of this, driving most of his spare time driving Uber, driving around Nairobi, you know, working for Uber in order to make ends meet, in order to support his community, who are all casual laborers who are trying, you know, to improve their lives together. So I mean, that may be far away right now, but if you look in the United States, quite frankly, where I find some of this is in communities that have begun to organize. Some of that happened for a while around the Occupy Wall Street movement. So an earlier book of mine is actually co-authored with Kwok Pui Lan, Asian woman theologian, was titled Occupy Religion, because we saw something really happening. Communities were coming together, you know, not just living in the city squares, but sort of a lot of this came out of communities that had already existed and then continued to exist afterwards. Black Lives Matter, even though sometimes that has been portrayed as being in conflict with the church, is a way of people of faith actually, you know, making a difference, putting not only their things into practice, but experiencing what these texts are talking about, and therefore being able to reread some of these ancient traditions. Me personally, I find a lot of this in the labor movement. Now that might shock a couple of listeners, but you know, just recently we had these UAW strikes in negotiating with General Motors. And one of them happened right south of here in Nashville, Spring Hill. So some of us went down, you know, sat with the workers. And those are people, mostly people of faith, you know. Those are people who are not just looking for a better paycheck, but who feel like this has something to do with, you know, the world at large, the way, you know, they envision God and themselves in it. And sometimes, you know, for years, you know, we've done Bible study in union halls. Did that more in Dallas still when I was teaching at another place. but that's a real possibility. And so, I mean, I could give you more examples, but sometimes it happens in places where we least expect it.
Not in the church, necessarily.
Now, see, here's my hope. I think through that we can bring it back into the churches, but it's not automatic, and the churches sometimes are on autopilot or, you know, just not getting deep enough into the real matters, you know, that really shape people's lives. And that's where Jesus was. I mean, Jesus, I mean, he couldn't really think of the old stories. I mean, not that he's not in the temple or in the synagogues, but the Jesus stories are not all about hanging about sacred places and doing worship. I mean, it's praying, you know, with your eyes open in the fields, in the streets, you know, in the neighborhoods.
Right. Well, the last question I wanted to ask you had to do with this short section in the conclusion of the book on Revelation, and only because a sort of misreading that I had, and I was curious about it. You talk a little bit about Revelation at the end, and you contest common views of Revelation by saying that Revelation in the life and ministry of Jesus might be better understood in terms of disclosing the difference that God makes here and now. And as I was reading some of the examples you gave of Revelation, one example is Jesus refusing the temptation of embracing top-down power. I kept misreading revolution for Revelation. So I wonder, is this just a misreading, or you know, is are these two concepts bound up at all in your thinking, revelation and revolution?
That's a great question. I appreciate that. And maybe it's just a typo, right?
No, well, I mean, it definitely says revelation in the text, but I kept seeing revolution.
No, I'm kidding. It's supposed to say revelation, but your question is right. I mean, I think, you know, this is the thing about revelation. There is something revolutionary about revelation. I mean, you know, one way of looking at revelation is just, you know, you get new knowledge, is something that comes to you, you know, that's sort of cool, or that you wouldn't get any other way. But I think what I'm saying ultimately is sort of what comes to you through the divine revealing itself to you is something that changes your life. It's something life-changing, not just for individuals, and that's a big thing too, but also for communities. So where, I mean, look at the Jesus movement itself, you know. If Jesus was simply reaffirming what everybody already believed and thought about, you know, that there would not have been much of a challenge there. But you know, at every time, you know, you work through the Gospels, and there's this pushback against Jesus. And the pushback comes from the dominant positions, you know, the establishment, the status quo. And it comes because they're afraid that Jesus could be dangerous. And so, like for instance, in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 3, Jesus, there's a healing by Jesus. And after the healing, there's a little remark that says, I think it's the Pharisees and the Herodians conspiring to kill him. So early on in his ministry, this is not just, you know, nice Jesus having a successful ministry, and then tragically he gets killed at the end. But early on, he pushes, you know, the buttons of the powerful. And keep in mind, this is not a critique of, again, of Jewish people or Judaism, but this is a critique of religious and political power brokers who want to get rid of Jesus. Now, the other thing about Revelation, you know, it's not just cognitive stuff. It's not just, you know, you learn something, you're understanding something. There's sort of a new way of looking at Jesus's ministry in terms of being an organizer. So, you know, for a long time we looked at Jesus as being a radical preacher. And then revelation for a preacher means the preacher tells you something about God, you learn something about God. But an organizer is building power, you know, bringing the community together. So the point of preaching is not just to change your mind or to tell you something you didn't know, but really to build community, to build power. And in that sense, if you think about that as revelation, that's also revolutionary. Richard Horsley, in one of his books, Jesus, I think, what is it called? Jesus and Empire is the book, talks about there being two persons by the name of Jesus at the time of Jesus of Nazareth who were both radical preachers. One was, of course, Jesus, the son of Joseph, the Christian Jesus of Nazareth. And the other one was Jesus, the son of Hananiah, somebody else. And the second Jesus, this Jesus, the son of Hananiah, was a very radical preacher who preached, damnation in front of the temple in Jerusalem every day. The Romans also took him in, they beat him up, and they let him go again. Now, Jesus of Nazareth, as you know, they took in, they beat him, and they killed him. So one was more dangerous than the other. Both were radical preachers. both preached fire and brimstone to some people. I mean, Jesus preached fire and brimstone, right? We forget that sometimes. This morning in class, we read Matthew 25, you know. Final judgment, judgment of the nation story, and there is that, right? There is judgment. But the more dangerous thing was probably not just that preaching, but the organizing, and so so this is where revelation and revolution are connected, I would
come
say.
Come together.
Yes, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you again for this discussion about your book.
Well, thank you, Chris. I always enjoy these questions. This makes me think again about what I did and what I'm really committed to. This is something, it's a short book, it's a book that I was asked to write some time ago, and I'm glad I did it because it sort of helped clarify a few things.
Thank you for sharing it with us. Again, I've been talking with Jörg Rieger, Distinguished Professor of Theology, Cal Turner Chancellor's Chair of Wesleyan Studies, and the Founding Director of the Wendland Cook Program in Religion and Justice, about his recent book, Jesus Versus Caesar, for People Tired of Serving the Wrong God, published by Abingdon Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page, or send me an email. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.